Eric Schlosser, the investigative reporter of Fast Food Nation fame, has assembled what reads like a top 10 Letterman list of hair-raising nuclear bungles and close calls with catastrophe. Command and Control is the book. It's sort of smelling salts for historical amnesia. In case you lived through the Cold War and forgot it or repressed it, it could scare the pants off you if you thought there was nothing to worry about. Eric Schlosser, thank you for this book. It's a long way from Fast Food Nation and almost as scary.
Unfortunately, I think a lot of these nuclear stories are a lot scarier. I mean, I think Big Macs can be harmful, but hydrogen bombs, even more harmful.
That could ruin a whole day, as Ronald Reagan used to say.
For hundreds of thousands and even millions of people.
We're talking about flocks of birds, the moon rising, all sorts of strange natural and unnatural things that got us awfully close to not just a false alarm, but triggering an attack. Explain, just on the pretty scary record of the past, how would a nuclear decider, could be one of ours, one of theirs, somebody we've never met, come to the wrong decision on pushing a button?
One of the things to keep in mind is that the pressure to make a decision quickly would be enormous. The flight time between the United States and the Soviet Union was about a half hour for a missile, but they could have launched, and the United States could have launched, a missile from a submarine, which might mean it could land within 5, 10, 15 minutes. So in the rules of nuclear warfare, as soon as you suspect you're under attack, there's enormous pressure to use your weapons or lose them. And within minutes, the decision has to be made. That puts enormous stress on the nuclear command and control system because our radars, our early warning network, has to tell us immediately if we're under attack, and it has to tell us accurately. And that's a real, real technological challenge. In 1960, with a certainty that was said to be 99%, our early warning system told us we were under attack. And it turned out to be the moon rising. In the late 1970s, someone inadvertently put into a computer at NORAD a training tape of what a Soviet attack on the United States would look like. And suddenly, our early warning system said we were under attack. It was highly realistic attack. It was so realistic because it was a training tape. And again, there was great concern and then a realization that there was a mistake. In one other instance, the failure of a computer chip sent an erroneous message that the United States was under attack by hundreds, if not thousands, of Soviet nuclear weapons. And Zbigniew Brzezinski, President Carter's national security advisor, was woken up in the middle of the night, told that the United States was likely to be under attack, and that a decision would have to be quickly made whether to retaliate. Thankfully, again, it was discovered that this was a mistake before Brzezinski got in touch with Carter and recommended how many missiles we should launch at the Soviet Union. One of the major themes of my book is that you have to look at nuclear weapons not as symbols of national power, but as machines. And like every other machine ever invented by people, they break down. They go wrong. And these nuclear weapons are attached to other machines like bombers or missiles, which are linked to other machines like early warning computers and communications networks. And the more complex these systems become, the more likely there are to be mistakes, to be breakdowns and errors. And the potential is catastrophic when one of these machines or one of these systems goes wrong.
Eric Schlosser, of course, it's not just us. I mean, I was reading just the other day about a Russian technician who saw something awfully suspicious, or I think he had to decide before Boris Yeltsin, or whoever it was, is this for real? He decided in uncertainty, and he erred, praise God, on the side of restraint. But walk us through those people who have to tell the deciders, yeah, this is a real thing, Mr. Big, you better let fly.
Yeah, and I'm critical of our command and control system, but I am pretty confident that during the Cold War to the present day, the Russian system has been even more fragile. And this was while Boris Yeltsin was president in the 90s. There was the launch of a weather rocket from Norway that was mistakenly believed to be the launch of an American ICBM off of a submarine. Now, in this case, it just didn't seem to make sense that we would be launching a surprise attack on Russia after the Cold War was over, but they had to very carefully analyze the launch and see what it was. The scariest near misses again and again were during the Cold War, when it at times seemed plausible to Americans that the Soviet Union would try to do a surprise attack, and particularly in the early 1980s, there were many in the Soviet Union who believed, especially while Yuri Andropov was head of the Soviet Union, they believed that Ronald Reagan was going to launch a surprise nuclear attack on the Soviet Union. And these were very, very dangerous times. Now, we're talking about problems with the early warning systems of both countries, but there were also problems with individual nuclear weapons that could go wrong. And that nearly accidentally detonated. These stories were kept secret during the Cold War, but now we know on a number of occasions American nuclear weapons almost detonated by accident on American soil and would have destroyed some of our cities, let alone entire states of the Union.
Give us an instance.
Again and again, you'll find that these accidental detonations could have been caused by remarkably trivial events. In Damascus, Arkansas, in September of 1980, a workman was working at a Titan II missile silo and dropped a socket, just a metal tool from a work platform. He tried to grab it after it fell. He missed it. It fell about 70 feet down the silo, hit the silo wall, ricocheted, and hit this Titan II missile, piercing a hole in the missile. And suddenly, thousands of gallons of highly explosive rocket fuel were pouring into the silo. Now, the reason that this was significant is that on top of that missile was the most powerful nuclear warhead the United States ever built. That one warhead was three times more powerful than all the bombs used by all the armies in the Second World War combined, including both atomic bombs. So one warhead, more than three times more powerful than everything that exploded during the Second World War. That story is the heart of my book, Command and Control, but there were many other stories. There was a workman who was called to a Minuteman site in South Dakota because there was a problem with the intruder alarm. So he opened up the fuse box to see what was wrong with the intruder alarm and didn't have the right tool with him, didn't have a fuse puller with him, but he had a screwdriver. So he started pulling out fuses with a screwdriver and suddenly heard a loud explosion in the silo. And he had basically launched the warhead off of the missile with its retro rockets. The warhead fell almost 100 feet, didn't detonate. But you wouldn't want to do that 5 or 10 times to see if it would detonate. In another story, a B-52 navigator for a long B-52 flight decided to bring on board 4 rubber seat cushions and put those seat cushions underneath one of the seats in the cockpit. What he didn't realize is that he was putting the seat cushions next to a heat vent. About halfway through the flight, the seat cushions caught on fire. Soon the bomber was on fire. This bomber was carrying 4 hydrogen bombs, which we now know had safety problems with them. And the bomber nearly crashed into one of our most top-secret important radar installations in Greenland. So this gets back to the complexity of these systems. When you're designing a B-52 or you're designing nuclear weapons, the last thing that you would expect is that a major nuclear catastrophe would be precipitated by 4 rubber seat cushions. The moral is that mankind is much better at designing complex technological systems than we are at controlling them, let alone understanding them as soon as something goes wrong.
Eric, given the record of Chernobyl's and Three Mile Island's, the astonishing thing is that given the thousands and thousands of warheads we've dealt with over the years, that the record isn't vastly worse, that we haven't been blown up several times already. Seriously.
I really give enormous credit to the technological proficiency of our weapons designers, to the administrative skills of those who are running our nuclear command and control system, and especially to the personal heroism of many people who served during the Cold War, who risked their lives and sometimes lost their lives trying to prevent a nuclear catastrophe. But everyone I interviewed for my book, weapons designers, former bomber crew members, launch officers, nuclear weapon repairmen, they were amazed that the Cold War ended without a major city being destroyed by an accidental detonation. And so luck played a significant role. And there's absolutely no guarantee that our luck will last. And the more of these weapons there are in the world, particularly as countries like India and Pakistan that don't have the same sort of technological proficiency that we do get these weapons, the more of these things are out there, the more likely that one of them is going to go off. And it's sort of amazing that a major city has not been destroyed by a nuclear weapon since 1945, but there's no guarantee our luck will last.
There was a time when everybody knew Dr. Strangelove, the movie, virtually by heart, in which case Jack D. Ripper, a kind of military officer gone nuts, triggers the end, and Slim Pickens goes down with the bomb over Russia somewhere. What about that kind of sort of malign intent somewhere buried in the bowels of the bureaucracy?
One of the real risks today is an insider within the nuclear command and control system somehow tampering with it. The probability is low. I'm not saying this is something that's going to happen tomorrow or next week. But certainly Dr. Strangelove, for all of its farcical elements, was an accurate depiction of the problem 50 years ago. There was nothing to prevent 50 years ago a rogue missile crew or bomber crew from using their nuclear weapons. There were no locks that required codes on those systems 50 years ago. Now, we have much more advanced controls today, but, you know, if some very low-level person in the NSA is able to get the most top secret secrets of the most secret intelligence agency the United States have, I think some of the things that Snowden obtained is information even the President of the United States was unaware of. If someone at the NSA could do that, then who's to say that someone in the nuclear command and control system couldn't mess around with it? I mean, the NSA is responsible for writing our nuclear codes. The NSA is responsible for some of the machinery that relies on those codes. And if you then look at Pakistan or India or Russia, where, again, there are probably less technologically sophisticated at controlling these weapons than we are, there's always the risk of an insider causing real problems.
It is strange and humbling that these things do come down to human judgments. Maybe the judgment of a madman who's going to blow up the world, or of in the Russian case recently, an intuitive saint who said, the evidence is ambiguous, Mr. Yeltsin, in effect, but don't.
Yeah, and in spending 6 years on this subject as I did, there were times when, honestly, I had to wonder about humanity and the idea that all this ingenuity and skill and scientific expertise could be used to create weapons that in an instant could kill hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. It's a very, very dark subject. On the other hand, it didn't happen during the Cold War. And it didn't happen because at crucial moments, people made the right decision. And at crucial moments, people decided not to use these weapons. And I guess that's the other side of the human element. And I think if we're going to greatly reduce the number of these weapons and someday hopefully eliminate them, it's that other side of our nature that we're going to have to count on for survival. I don't think it's inevitable that the world be threatened by these weapons, but it's going to take people drawing upon that other side of their nature to work to greatly reduce the number and someday eliminate them.
Eric Schlosser, I love your tribute to thousands of professional, conscientious designers and people watching that system over many, many years. I'm interested, too, though, that you single out three people that you especially admire in the, you know, public figures for their instincts around these questions. And it's kind of a surprise to me. Ronald Reagan, Robert McNamara, and Curtis LeMay himself. I mean, explain those choices.
Curtis LeMay was the general who really played the most important role in the creation of our nuclear command and control systems and its sensibility. He was head of the Strategic Air Command at its peak in the 1950s. He was parodied not only in Dr. Strangelove, but in other films as a mad bomber. And there were all kinds of political views that he had, and later military strategic views that I strongly disagree with. But what I admired in him was his absolute dedication to eliminating error in the control of these dangerous weapons. His insistence on checklists and standard operating procedures and an intolerance for laziness or sloppiness and a sense of esprit de corps that he created in his men, which really led them to believe this was the most important job. There was no room for mistakes. There was no room for errors. And if you're going to have nuclear weapons, you want that kind of sensibility among the people who operate them. Robert McNamara and his behavior in the beginnings and the running of the Vietnam War was disastrous. But when it came to nuclear weapons, he was very concerned from the start when he became Secretary of Defense that our weapons were too loosely controlled, that individual officers had the power to use them in a way that could be catastrophic. And McNamara began the process, which in retrospect seems so obvious, but at the time was resisted by many in the military, of putting locks on the weapons, so that in order to use a nuclear weapon, you needed to have access to the right code. Ronald Reagan began his administration as the most ardent Cold Warrior believer in nuclear weapons, huge expansion in military spending, and huge expansion in spending on our arsenal. But by the end of his term in office, was sincerely committed to abolishing all nuclear weapons. And oddly enough, the film The Day After, which was seen by millions and millions of Americans, very scary television movie about what would happen to the United States during a nuclear attack, had a real impact on him. He saw the movie. It scared the hell out of him. And I also think that the huge anti-nuclear protests, not only throughout Western Europe, but in the United States, the anti-nuclear protest in Central Park, I think in 1982, was the biggest political rally in American history, almost 750,000 people. I think Reagan responded to this popular outrage about nuclear weapons, as well as his own fear that there might be a nuclear war and the weight of responsibility he had as president to make these sorts of decisions turned him into a real abolitionist. So all three of the figures you mentioned, LeMay, McNamara, Reagan, highly complex people, not easily stereotyped, and on this issue actually had some very good qualities.
Who, Eric, among the responsible public figures has been least, shall we say, attentive to the dangers, least respectful of the problem?
It would be too simplistic to look back at this nuclear history and see heroes and villains. What's scary in some ways is the madness of the entire enterprise. One of the things that McNamara said in looking back at the nuclear arms race is that step by step, you had this incredible transformation in which each step seemed reasonable and logical at the time, and yet step by step led to a place of total madness and insanity. You know, in the late 1940s, Dwight D. Eisenhower thought you would only need maybe 150 to 200 nuclear weapons to completely destroy the Soviet Union and eliminate it as a functioning society. So in the late 1940s, 150 to 200 were all the United States really seems to need. And yet by the end of Eisenhower's presidency, the United States was well along the path to having 30,000 nuclear weapons. And this just is an instance of how step by step we wound up in a place of total madness. And because nuclear weapons were seen not as machines, not as weapons in and of themselves too often, but as symbols of national strength and power, there was this notion whoever had more weapons was more powerful. So at our high point, the United States had 32,000 nuclear weapons, but the Soviet Union, in order to outdo us, had 35,000. And there's no conceivable military use for 35,000 nuclear weapons. When with the hydrogen bombs that were and warheads that were eventually developed, you could effectively destroy American and Soviet society maybe with 20, 30 weapons, and yet each side wound up with 30,000. So we were very, very fortunate that the Cold War ended without nuclear war or without nuclear disasters. And it's very concerning that anyone in their right mind would think about having a new Cold War with Russia, having any kind of new arms race. And yet you find both in Russia and the United States right now politicians who almost seem nostalgic for that rhetoric. One of the leading newscasters in Russia recently boasted that Russia could turn the United States into radioactive ashes. You know, that kind of rhetoric hasn't been spoken in half a century. In the United States, there are some politicians who seem delighted to have Russia as an enemy again. And they just seem to have forgotten how lucky we were to get out of the last one alive.
What's your own hope as a citizen, Eric Slusser, of cutting these arsenals down, maybe even eliminating them?
My hope is that we have a real national debate once again on nuclear weapons, what they're for, how they'd be used, and how many we need. There is remarkable historical amnesia on this subject. Half the American people either were not yet born or were small children when the Cold War ended and have almost no knowledge of these weapons, their destructiveness. So I support the abolition of nuclear weapons, but I'm not a believer in unilateral disarmament. I think that we really need to reduce the number that we have and engage in meaningful discussions with the other countries that have nuclear weapons to greatly reduce the number with the hope of someday eliminating them all. The alternative, really, is that a major city or cities are going to be destroyed by these weapons.
Would you bet by accident or by malign intent?
I think that it's more probable that a weapon will be used deliberately, but as long as these weapons exist fully assembled, the possibility of one being detonated by accident is greater than zero. And that's higher than I feel comfortable with.
Eric Slusser, it's a great pleasure to read your book, Command and Control, and to gab with you about questions that just don't go away. Thank you.
Well, thank you.